CataractCoach.com. Welcome back to our podcast series. And today's podcast number 2 with Dr. Richard L. Lindstrom. Well, welcome, Dr. Lindstrom. This is our Cataract Coach podcast where we're talking to innovative leaders in ophthalmology and kind of doing a deeper dive. So it'll be a free-flowing conversation. But I want to just start off by telling you the first time I met you. I was a senior resident. The ASCRS in the year 2000 was in Boston. And it was a big trip to go from Los Angeles to Boston, but I went with a co-resident, and I saw you give a talk about how to do tilt and tumble, a phaco technique that you pioneered. And I was blown away because here I mistakenly thought that whatever I learned in residency would be it. And then I'd use that knowledge and go and practice. And I didn't realize there was a whole world out there. And so that got me thinking. And, you know, after befriending you more than 20 years ago, what I really admired about you is that you're always at the forefront of the changes in ophthalmology, the evolution, the revolution, and the progression. And so how has ophthalmology changed over the years? What's the general trend that you see from your expert eyes?
Well, the good news is that our field, ophthalmology, continues to support investment and innovation, which is wonderful for our patients and for us. Recently, Raymond James did sort of a count, and according to them, there's 250 startups in ophthalmology right now. And so there's venture money and private equity money investing in ophthalmology. And when both human and financial capital are invested in the field, then there are advances. And to me, that's been fun from the beginning. I've always been interested in new technology, adopting new techniques, and working with industry to advance the field.
It's very admirable how you've always seemed to be at the very cutting edge, but you don't kind of realize that for every one company that really takes off, a couple others don't quite make it. So what's that like?
Well, there's certainly, you know, been failures, and I guess the largest graveyard for me has been trying to develop surgical techniques to treat presbyopia. Certainly over the last decade, I was involved in Refractec and conductive keratoplasty that we commercialized, and it didn't succeed. I was involved in developing the camera inlay that we, basically commercialized. It didn't succeed. And then, several startups that never even made it. So I would say, not everyone, new technology, succeeds and actually gets FDA approval. And even those that get FDA approval, not every technology succeeds in the marketplace.
Speaking of presbyopia, where do you think we're headed? Now that I hit the age of 50, now I actually believe presbyopia is real. Once it hit me.
It's real. Well, we've got three, alternatives other than glasses and contact lenses. And we have multifocal and progressive glasses and contact lenses, and we have monovision with optical correction. But on the other than optical correction side, we've got the pharmacologic treatment of refractive errors, and that today is miotic drops with one FDA-approved Vuity and several on the way. We do have some corneal refractive surgery approaches, primarily monovision. Presbylasic is another one of those that I was involved in clinical trials on that never actually even got to FDA approval, but for some patients, monovision works extremely well. And I think the really growth opportunity is in refractive cataract surgery, if you will.
Sure.
Refractive lens-based surgery, refractive lens exchange, and that's where we're seeing meaningful growth right now.
For your average ophthalmologist, how do you keep up with so many different advances in the field? Do you ultra-specialize? Do you try to just cast a wide net?
Well, I'm forced to a little bit. This is my 40th year on the editorial board of Ocular Surgery News, and I started as associate medical editor when it was founded 40 years ago with Don Sanders as editor, and then I, about 30 years ago, became editor. And they make me or ask me to write a perspective or commentary on every feature article, so I've been doing that for 30 years, and it's in every field. And basically what I do is I do research, and I look at, what would be interesting to me that I didn't know, and then I share it with my readers. That's one thing. The other thing is that the first 10 years of my practice, I was in a multi-specialty academic medical center. I was the director of the corneal service at the University of Minnesota and chief at the Minneapolis VA hospital, so we dealt with everything. And in my current practice, Minnesota Eye Consultants, we also have every subspecialty. So I get to, you know, interact with my colleagues in every field as well. So those two things primarily, and then, of course, some interaction at meetings helps as well.
So it really is a commitment to lifelong learning, if you will.
Yeah, that's right. When I entered medical school, actually, I was somewhat close to the dean, and the dean at that time, what he spoke about all the time is that medicine is and requires lifelong learning. So it's exactly what you just said. It's never over. There's always going to be advances and innovations. I first entered ophthalmology 50 years ago now, and so, you know, in my residency, I was trained as an intracapsular cataract surgeon. We did use a microscope. My program was advanced as far as using microsurgical approaches, but what we do in every single field is totally changed. We only do penetrating keratoplasty in those days in retina. There were no anti-VEGFs, just some early laser therapy for diabetic retinopathy. There was basically no treatment for wet and dry AMD. So, you know, it's really been huge advances that have occurred, and it's accelerating. So for the resident training today or the young ophthalmologists, these advancements are accelerating, and they're accelerating because, as I said, our field is supporting investment. And when there's investment in your field, both human and financial capital, then advancements occur.
So, cataract coach is really popular among the younger ophthalmologists, say age 30 to 50. So I think one thing I want to try to emphasize to them is your residency and your fellowship are fantastic, but they're the foundation for the rest of your learning.
Yes, well, you have to continue to add new things to your practice, and it's a challenge, in your residency, while you've got someone right there by your side, and usually you're not maybe in some cases even taking care of your own personal patients, it's a different responsibility when you start to adopt new technologies on your own personal patients, but it's required, and looking at today, in my opinion, to be successful, you have to be a refractive cataract surgeon. If you're in the cataract field, I really believe the comprehensive ophthalmologist has to do MIGS. Microinvasive glaucoma surgery is to me a requirement. I think the really successful practice probably should be looking at the medical therapy of retina. So many residents today do lots of retinal injections and intravitreal injections, and I think that's going to be part of comprehensive ophthalmology as we go forward. We're going to soon have therapies for dry AMD, starting with geographic atrophy, but maybe moving down the food chain to more advanced dry AMD. So those things you may or may not have been exposed to in your residency, and so you have to adopt them. And I found it certainly very, very doable. I mean, one needs to do the training. I'm a big advocate, besides meetings, of actually going and visiting people who are early into these fields when you're going to add something. So what I've always done is gone and side by side, worked with people in their practices, and that's been one of the better educational approaches for me. And we have this wonderful ophthalmic fraternity, sorority, if you will, and we can, we can call people and say, "Can I come and just watch what you do?" And people do it with you all the time. People, have done it with our practice all the time, and I've traveled all around the world and gone into people's clinics, gone into people's ORs, and it's a much better learning experience than simply going to a meeting.
It's funny you say that. So on Cataract Coach, I post a new video every day. And of the 365 videos of 2022, the number one most popular one was where I simply put my phone camera on the wall of my OR and recorded everything that happened from the start of one case to the start of the next case. Just because people want to see, as you said, what happens behind the scenes in the operating room.
Right. Yeah, what do you usually do? And I've been around a while, and one of my early friends was Charles Kelman, and he created a program that he called Surgicus. And what he did is he went around, and you had to sign up. I was one of the surgeons that was involved, and And what you had to agree to do was to let them come into your OR and film every case for that day, even if you did something, that you were a little embarrassed about, or if you had some complications or whatever it was. That's what they really wanted to uncover. And there was no editing. It was just every case the way it went. And there, of course, would be some beautiful cases, but there'd be some more challenging cases. And Surgicast, one of those that I remember, I actually had an impending choroidal hemorrhage. It was a phaco case, so it was easy to manage, but it was real. And people got to, watch that if you simply closed the wound, you could manage the case. So,
yeah, that's a great idea, because people sometimes forget that the videos you see at meetings or online are cherry-picked.
Yeah, well, they pick if you're going to show something at a teaching program, at a meeting, you're going to pick one of your better cases, and then you're going to edit it down from and you might even speed it up, right, times 1.5 times. Those are the, classical, in quotes, tricks to make it look smooth. So you're at 1.5 times your pace, and you've edited out any of the, and the glitches, if you will. So, but you go watch somebody live, and you see how they interact with the patients in between. You see how the patients come into their operating room, how they leave, how they manage the traffic, and how they interact with the patients, what they say to the patients. My friend Bobby Osher has this book called What I Say that I participated in. And just listening to people that are, experienced and expert interact with patients, a great learning experience.
Oh, fantastic. Now, about live surgery events, they were more popular, it seems, a decade ago. Do you think we're going to get back to doing more live surgery events? It was one of my favorite things.
Yeah, I helped found a program actually in Italy with the Italian Society of Cataract Refractive Surgery, first with Lucio Barato and then with Matteo Piovella, where the whole meeting was live surgery, and you've been there and participated, and you saw some amazing things from surgeons around the world during those meetings. We saw cases where the surgeons in the middle of a case just would say no more and get up and say they couldn't finish the case, and someone else would have to come in and do it. And these were, in quotes, some of the top surgeons in the world. And the Surgicus is video, but we still have the live program that Alcon puts on at the at ASCRS and AAO. I think, live surgery is a great learning experience, and even better, though, is to actually, go on site and spend
a day
and watch. Cataract Coach is a fabulous program, Uday, but what I would encourage people to do is come and spend a day with you, and it's even a more valuable experience. So,
oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, if you do participate in that meeting, I've learned the most important saying is guarda la luce, look at the light.
look at the light if it's in Spanish, and un poco dolorosa, a little bit of pain, whatever. So, and often, it's a challenge sometimes because you have a scrub nurse, you've never worked in that OR, you have a scrub person who's never worked with you, and an anesthetist that's never worked with you, and I've done these live programs around the world, and we could talk for an hour about some of the fun stories in that regard, but it is a valuable learning experience for everyone to see that type of live surgery, and to see me do a single case in Thailand or a single case in Italy is valuable, but more valuable would be to come and watch me work for a day in Minneapolis. So,
for sure. Now, if you're trying a new technology, let's say a new surgical procedure, a new device, a new IOL, how do you explain to your patient that they may be the first patient you're doing this for?
Well, I've always done it in a very honest and direct fashion, but also sort of a thoughtful and tactful fashion. So we tell patients when we're adopting new technologies that we, are adopting the new technology. Usually it's actually not something that's totally different than anything we've ever done before. So we're simply making an incremental advance in what we've done before. If patients, aren't ready for that, if that's the right word, then, there are alternatives that they can do.
Sure.
I've been a big advocate, I spent a decade in academics, full-time geographic academics, but I'm a big advocate of what I call the academic private practice. And when I went into private practice, that's what I wanted to create. And the academic private practice, today is involved in clinical trials and in teaching. And so many times you are adapting these new technologies in a clinical trial. And so the patients who enter in a clinical trial,
they know.
You know, get meaningful informed consent about the fact sure. that, you know, this is a new technology. Here's the, you know, here's the risks, benefits, and alternatives. And they're, you know, allowed to say yay or nay. And most of us think when we're engaging in the clinical trial, we've got something to offer that could be an advance. But in the modern world, you know, there clearly does need to be, you know, proper informed consent, and
sure.
and patients should have a choice, and they do have a choice.
Now, talking about academic medicine, so I did something similar to you where I actually retired this year after 22 years of teaching residents. I had a fantastic time, but it was time to change gears, pass the baton, if you will. But I was fortunate. I did, in parallel, a private practice half the week and academics half the week. And I thought that was a fantastic thing. For our younger viewers, for Cataract Coach, can you kind of give us the differences of academic versus private practice, challenges of each, and how about making the transition from one to the other?
Well, the I personally think if someone has the training and is offered the opportunity in a place they desire to live to start in an academic medical center, either part-time or full-time, that they should take that opportunity. So we train fellows still today, and those that can and are given the opportunity, I think, to gain that academic experience, particularly you have so much to bring to the
sure.
young residents right out of your training, that is a positive, and you can relate to them, you know, very effectively. The most fun thing about academics for me was the interaction with the residents and the fellows. And so we had, you know, first when I was on the cornea service and ran the VA hospital service, you know, I had a first, a second, and a third year resident and a fellow. So we had all the different years. You build some, you know, wonderful relationships
sure.
and do some very useful things. Now in private practice, or in quotes, academic medical practice at Minnesota Eye Consultants, we still train fellows, and so at that post-graduate level, if you will, that's rewarding as well, but it's not quite the same as being immersed in the whole thing. It used to be if you wanted to do, you know, meaningful clinical research, it was mostly done at academic centers. Now it's not anymore, really.
Sure.
More is done in private practice. But if you want to do bench research of any sort,
basic
that's
science.
Pretty much reserved. Yeah. And I did bench research original research in cornea preservation in some early areas. I couldn't have done that in private practice, and I could do that at an academic center. But it's really easy to go from an academic center into private practice, has been my experience. And it's more difficult, not impossible, but more difficult to go from private practice into an academic
sure.
Medical center. So if you get that opportunity as a young doctor, typically
take it.
You'll be fellowship trained.
Yeah.
I would encourage people to take it. So,
yeah, I think one of the most meaningful things for me is, you know, I've trained 200 residents all across the country, some even international, and then I feel almost like a proud dad seeing them do such amazing things
yeah.
in their career.
Yeah, that's been the most fun. When you know, I've done some inventing, and I've done a lot of writing, over 400 peer-reviewed publications. I've been the editor at OSN, a lot of education, travel around the world teaching, met a lot of wonderful people. But when people ask me, you know, what do you rank the most personally gratifying, it's the fellows that I've trained.
Sure.
And, you know, certainly residents as well and colleagues as well. But when you spend a whole year with someone, which is what you do in a fellowship, and actually when I was at the university, we sometimes had two-year fellows, so you spend 1 to 2 years with someone, you build an amazing relationship. And,
sure.
you know, those 80 or so that I've had that relationship with over the past, since 1978 when I started, you know, those relationships are very special. They're very precious. So that's, you know, as I look back, that's the one thing that I would say was the most gratifying, or that I definitely, if I had to give everything up, I wouldn't want to give up. Of course, you have to be a clinician and have practice.
Of course.
I wouldn't want to give up the fellowship training that I was engaged in.
Oh, I can relate so much. I've been only retired now for a few months from teaching residents, and I miss them. I miss hanging out with them.
For sure, yeah. And you were mainly working with second and third year residents, probably, and so.
Well, yeah. Well, my main thing was actually fourth year residents in the OR. I wanted to
get your skills. That's kind of like a fellowship, yeah. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's really fun for a surgeon, and you know, I always had a surgery dominated practice, and so do you. And so, really, you know, teaching those skills and transferring that knowledge and skill is very rewarding. So,
changing gears a little bit, what do you think about the future with private equity in ophthalmology? Because this is not the first time private equity has been involved. And I remember back when I was probably even in med school, maybe early 90s. There was a big foray as well. Where do you see all this? Is it still good opportunities for young doctors coming out of training? What's your input here?
Well, our group, Minnesota Eye Consultants, was the founding practice in a private equity consolidation called Unify Vision Partners. We're into our sixth year, so I've lived it. We actually also were involved in the physician practice management company consolidation a decade or more ago, and working with a company called Vision 21. So I've done both, plus I've been in academic medical care, and I've been in private independent medical care. The PPMC model, was flawed. It wasn't really a private equity model. It was more of a public company arbitrage model where you shared a certain amount of a practice's revenue in return for public stock. And in most of those companies sort of took off like a rocket and then crashed because it wasn't sustainable. And so that was a flawed model. Fortunately, most of us did okay with it and were able to, get out of it and recover. But it damaged some practices, so it was sort of sad. The private equity model is slightly different. In the private equity model, you're actually selling your practice. And so there are, multiple practice consolidators today. I mean, there are hospitals that are buying practices. There are, United Healthcare, an insurer, is, buying a lot of practices and doctors. I think United Healthcare employs something like 60,000 doctors.
Wow.
Not so much in ophthalmology, but if you count private care and internal medicine and the like, they're a major consolidator. And so private equity is basically, another consolidator. And again, it depends significantly on who you choose as a partner, but for for the partner in a practice who has built meaningful value over time, partnering with private equity can be positive, especially if it's a practice that can and wants to grow. So our partners have done, really good, and I would say they would all vote yes again. 6 years later, as they did 5 years before. We had 100% yes votes in our 10 partners at Minnesota Eye, and I think they would all still vote yes. Not to say that it's perfect, because you do bring, another partner in, and just like, solo practice where you just decide is different than a partnership. Younger doctors is a legitimate question, and so we have found that we've been able to recruit really high-quality people to join our practice. We have created a way in our practice for the younger doctor that joins us to also be able to equity integrate.
Oh, nice.
There is not every private equity company does that. And so it is something that you need to be, thoughtful about. I just think the winds of change, as I say, they keep blowing. But right today, I think in ophthalmology, something like 2 out of 3, maybe even 7 out of 10, young ophthalmologists that come out of training actually come out and become employee doctors. I mean, there's
a... Wow, so different world.
Yeah, it's a different world than it used to be. And if you look in other fields, it's like 90% that come out and are employee doctors. You might be employed by an academic medical center. You might be employed by a county hospital. You might be employed by a VA. You might be employed by a group like Kaiser. You might be employed by United Healthcare. You might be employed by a big hospital chain, or you might be employed in close by a private equity company. So the opportunities for totally independent practice are declining. But I still think there's something valuable about having an equity integration opportunity to be able to participate in the value growth. And so we've designed, Unify Vision Partners to allow that to continue. And again, we found that in that kind of a setting, we're still able to recruit, the best and the brightest into our practice.
I think one thing the younger generation of ophthalmologists does very well, and better than certainly my generation did, is figuring out that work-life balance. And I think maybe if you have a situation where they are, you know, more so employee-based, maybe it's worth it to them to have more life work-life balance.
Well, you live in California, so you probably, and you've watched The Residents, and I'm only passing this on second hand, but if I go back, maybe 30 years ago, it was not the top resident in a program was usually going into a practice where they, would be able to become an equity owner. My understanding is that many of the top residents that finish training today are quite highly motivated to join a Kaiser or some other system like that. They're guaranteed, immediately a good salary. They're guaranteed good benefits. There's a kind of a set retirement age like sure. There is in the airlines, so they know they're going to retire comfortably after 30 to 35 years, and they're not going to have to manage the practice, which can be onerous and challenging. So there's certainly some things to say for joining that big established group practice, out of training. I think the good news is all of those opportunities still exist in our field. But 7 out of 10, if you will, of the opportunities that a person finishing residency training or fellowship training today, 7 out of 10 of the opportunities that are available are going to be in a setting where you will be an employee doctor, a very well compensated and employee doctor with a very high quality and rewarding lifestyle, in my opinion. But that's definitely been a change in my lifetime. It used to be the only employee doctors were in academic medical centers or maybe working for a VA or a Hennepin County or in our city, the Minneapolis County Hospital.
Yeah, it's a kind of a interesting idea that, you can balance out things that are more important to you. One of the mistakes I made was years ago when I was doing a lot of ophthalmic consulting was taking so many trips, even international trips every month, that I didn't spend enough time with my kids. And it was you who gave me the advice and said, spend the time with your kids. Ophthalmology will still be here. And now that my kids are grown up, adult kids living on the East Coast, that was the best advice ever. So yeah. I think if the young generation can balance it out and have that work-life balance, spend more time with their families at the earlier part of their career, maybe the overall trade-off's worth it.
Yeah, it worked out well for you. So when I sit down with my fellows and perhaps occasionally some other younger ophthalmologists that seek me out, I'm a big believer in what I call a 5-year plan. I think it's hard to look farther ahead than 5 years.
Sure.
And it's just not a 5-year plan. It's sort of a 1-year, 3-year, 5-year plan. But I'm on my 11th 5-year plan. The first one is your training plan, and I did 3-year residency and 2 years of fellowship. But in that plan, you sit down with the people that are important to you. It could be your significant other. It could be other members of the family. It could be your children.
Sure.
And in your case, I think that was the person and the two people to sit down with. And you make a 1-3-5-year plan that works for everyone.
Sure.
And I was very compulsive about it. I mean, I could tell you, I can even do it today because I'm on my 11th 5-year plan. If you ask me, what will you be doing on November 22nd, 3 years from now, I could say, currently I plan to be X. Now, you might make a change, along the way for one reason or another, but I plan to be here and I plan to take this many weeks off and I plan to do the following. And this is, what I want to accomplish in my professional life, my personal life, my spiritual life, and interacting with friends. And it turns out what you plan is what happens. And so,
yeah. So
for your case, when we were talking, I'm on my 11th 5-year plan, right? So if you take 2 or 3 out of 11 5-year plans,
it's no big deal.
Off for your children, there's still... I think I'm planning on 12 5-year plans in ophthalmology, so that'll be 60 years. So if I took 3 off, that's only 15 out of 60 years.
Yeah.
Right. And those years with your children are really important. So I do think you know, that I tell people, come out of practice, you know, work hard, build a quality practice, spend time with your family, and then you'll be surprised how quickly, you know, they'll be off to college. And,
yeah, the years go by.
Then, if you're interested, then you've still got 30 years left to, to teach and do research and interact with industry if you wish. And what you find is that you'll what you think you might want to do 30 years from now might not be what you really want to do 30
sure.
years from now. Just like for you, 10 years ago, you wanted to teach residents, and then for whatever reason, now you decided it's not as high a priority, right? So, and you're now, fortunately for us, now we're seeing you back at, you know, all of the meetings that I'm involved in, because you're a great teacher, and, you know, congratulations on Cataract Coach.
Oh, thank you.
But just from the podium, you're a superb teacher, and so we're delighted to have you back. But it's not like, ophthalmology failed because you took a few years off to spend with your family, right?
Yeah, of course.
And the transition out and the transition in were comfortable, so... And nobody grudges people, and I tend to be really honest. I'm sort of have that Midwest honest and direct, and so when people, call me up and ask me to do something, you know, I just say, I've sort of reached my maximum for that month, and my plate's full, and I need some time with my wife and my kids, and, most of them are pretty understanding. Not all, but most of them are pretty understanding. And I invite people to do something and they say no for family and personal reasons, I say back is family first. You're doing the right thing, you know. So we'll invite you back next year. So,
well, I love the idea of the 5-year plan, because you're right. Yeah. It's hard to make a 10-year plan. It seems so onerous. So
too long, yeah. It's too long, and you're what you want to do changes, and what your family wants to do changes. So I sit down with my wife, and as the first party in my current life, after the Christmas and between then and in January, we spend a week just talking about what did we like about last year, what would we like to be better about next year, and then we think a little farther ahead. You know, I do 1, 3, and 5, and we write it down. And,
wow, that's neat.
And we gut check it and, do a little bit of, it's just like in a company, you have quarterly board meetings, right? So we have
it's your board meeting.
3 out of 12, 6 out of 12, 9 out of 12. And then after 12 months, how did the company do last year? How did you personally in your relationship with each other do? Did you have enough time for your kids? And I have 2 children and I have 5 grandchildren. You know, did we have enough time for them? Did we have enough time for each other? And it's easy then to put it in a calendar and just block out more personal time. So
yeah, I'm gonna try that 5. I like that idea, the 5-year plan, and just kind of dividing it up into 5-year segments.
Yeah, well I feel like I can look that far ahead. And again, looking back on it, here I am. I'm like I said, I just began my 11th 5-year plan in ophthalmology. I first started in ophthalmology in 1972, believe it or not. But I'm on my 11th 5-year plan. I think I've got 2 more 5-year plans. But I'll have to see how my health and everything is after this 5-year plan. But I know what I'm doing and want to do over the next 5 years. And a lot of it has to do with things I want to do with my wife, Jackie, and my 2 children, Michelle and Michael, and their 5 children. And so that goes right in the calendar as just as important as the American Academy of Ophthalmology or the American Society of Cataract and Refractive Surgery or an ocular surgery news meeting or whatever.
That's fantastic advice. Another thing that young doctors ask me about very frequently is how can they get involved in ophthalmic consulting, work with the companies, and in essence, kind of helping lead where our field will go in the future. What's your sage advice for a young doctor a few years out of training who desires to be working with the companies, doing some innovation on the podium, et cetera?
Yeah, so sometimes people will be in too big a hurry, I think. And so since we're going to have 50 to 60 years of practice, I tell them, it bothers them sometimes, but I tell the current resident that you know, you're going to probably not only have to, but want to practice at least until you're 80, and you're 30 now when you finish your training, so you've got at least 10 5-year plans. So the first couple of 5-year plans are to build a big practice, you know. So if you're going to be, in quotes, a key opinion leader, you can't do it without a meaningful practice.
Sure.
And so the first thing is to build a meaningful practice. And then find something that you're really passionate about. Because if you're going to, you know, work all week till Friday night and get on an airplane and go somewhere either for a meeting or a medical advisory board, if it's not something you're passionate about, you know, you won't persist.
Sure.
And so is it cataract surgery? Is it the cornea? Is it glaucoma? It can be any of those fields. But once you build a meaningful practice in that area, and then are interested in taking the next step, the easiest thing is to start to get involved in clinical trials. And you can just do that by working with the local rep or calling Uday Devgan. And he can introduce you to, you know, a company that is, you know, interested in young doctors, and they all are.
Sure.
And engaging them in clinical trials. They'll come out and do a site visit at your practice, and the first thing they're going to look at is, if you say, I want to do clinical trials in keratoplasty, and they come out and you do 3 keratoplasties a year, you know, that's not going to work, right?
So
basically, the first thing that's important to someone doing clinical trials, and there's new ones starting every day, is that in that area is recruitment. And so they want, you know, young doctors who can do quality surgery. Let's talk about surgery, because it can be in medical therapy as well, that can do the cases and have the patients. And then you do need to build a bit of an infrastructure to support that. So you need a research person who is sort of focused on that. And then as you start to participate in these clinical trials, you become a world expert in that new thing, right?
So sure.
If you're the first one that ever did a excimer laser, treatment for myopia, if you're the first one that ever did it, well, you are almost instantaneously, or even in the first 20 that did it,
sure,
you're instantaneously a key opinion leader. And if that gets number one, the companies want to pick your brain, so now you're on a medical advisory board.
Yep.
And then number two, they want you to train the next generation of doctors how to do it once it's FDA approved. And then once you're at that level, you know, once you're being invited to the meetings, you're being invited to medical advisory board meetings, you have proven that you're a good clinical investigator. It just snowballs, and then you have the problem that you had, Uday. Yeah. Now what do I do? Because I'm getting on an airplane every Friday,
and exactly.
I'm flying somewhere, and my kids are getting ready to enter high school, and I've got to, you know, get it back under control. But once you prove yourself, the demand is high. But you don't immediately go from, I finished my residency yesterday, I don't have any practice, and now I want to join the XYZ company medical advisory board. You know, first you have to build a practice.
Sure.
And then kind of stake your ground. What areas and specialties are you interested in? And then prove yourself, as a clinician surgeon in clinical trials. And then it just goes automatically from there. And then if you decide you want to get involved in, the next level, there are opportunities to be involved in investment and innovation and even serve on boards, et cetera. But that tends to be more like 5-year plan number 8, when you get to that level. And so you're just sort of coming up on that level now. So,
well, I love the pearl. So first, build your practice. So you have a busy practice.
Right.
Focus on something that's your passion. If you're passionate about a surgery, you're going to naturally excel in that. So I like that idea as well. And then be patient. It's going to take time. Be patient with it. And if you are involved with a clinical trial, be meticulous.
Yeah, there's nothing worse than talking a company into adding you to a clinical trial, and here you are 6 months out, and you've only recruited one patient.
Yeah.
For example, that's it happens. You know, I'm on the other side of it nowadays, right? So I'm there trying to pick the 10 or 12 or 15 sites, maybe 20 sites that are going to do a clinical trial, and we have some that 6 months out they haven't enrolled a single patient. Well, you know, that is not a win for anyone, right?
Sure. So. You got to know your patient population. In the last 10, 15 years, I've shied away from being involved in clinical trials only because I know my Beverly Hills patients actually often do not want to participate in any trial, regardless of what the financial incentive is.
That's right.
So know your population.
They might not. And so a way for you to do that, and maybe a way for some to do that, is to do what you did, from a teaching perspective,
yes.
Right? So you can, my two super high quality senior partners, the two people that joined me after I founded my private practice, Tom Samuelson and David Harton, who are sort of household names in glaucoma and cornea, the first 10 years of their practice, they did what you did. They practiced at Minnesota Eye Consultant 3 days a week, and they practiced at the
county hospitals.
Yeah. County teaching hospitals 2 days a week. So Monday, Wednesday, Friday, they were at Minnesota Eye Consultants building a consultative practice. Tuesday, Thursday, they were teaching the residents. And, of course, no better way to build a consultative practice than to teach the residents, right?
So, absolutely.
But they did clinical trials, and we did them in our practice, of course, as well. But, I mean, they could also do that type of clinical trial in that academic medical center. So,
what's another important concept, that your practice pattern and your practice style, it will evolve with time. The way
That's
you start off is not what you're going to do for life. And similarly, your first job may be amazing, but I say your first job is often like your first boyfriend or girlfriend. They're fantastic, but it may not be the one you're with forever. So I think, it's an important concept that your practice can change or morph with time, and you can start off being part-time private practice, part-time academics, part-time county hospital, and then go from there.
Absolutely. You can, as I said, you can go academics to private and even back to academics. You know, one of my great models for that is my good friend, Roger Steinert. He went, he was at Harvard, and then he went into ophthalmology consultants of Boston, and then he became chairman at UC Irvine. It's always, you can move in any direction. And I've seen the studies, and about 50% of residents land in a practice that makes them happy and they stay there.
Sure.
But about 50% change at least once, and about 20% change twice. And for me, I actually changed, I'm in my, at Minnesota Eye, I'm in my third practice. I started in private practice in Dallas, Texas, joined the faculty at the University of Minnesota, and was chief at the Minneapolis VA, did that for a decade. Then founded Minnesota Eye. So for me, it was three, and it wasn't because any of them were bad, but both personal reasons and/or my wife didn't like Dallas, so that was why I moved back to Minneapolis. And then I finally my private practice, my clinical practice got so big, it wasn't manageable in an academic geographic academic medical center. So I kind of had to go either change my, what I wanted to do, or go into private practice, because it turns out that most academic medical centers are not quite as efficient as most private practices can be if you own your own ASC and the like. So
sure. Do you think for ASCs, good topic, are we going to move more into office-based surgery, clinic-based surgery?
Well, we are, but what I tell everyone today is if you can, you need to be on the facility side to be best positioned, if you will, for success and prosperity in modern ophthalmology. Ideally, it's an ASC, but there are certain environments where people, because of certificates of need or other reasons, are locked out of participating in an ambulatory surgery center. And I think for those patients, for those doctors, an office-based surgery center is an option. Office-based surgery centers do especially well if you have meaningful private pay.
Sure.
And so when you're looking at doing that, if you've got a lot of, if you will, premium IOLs, you're doing refractive lens exchanges, you're doing phakic IOLs, maybe you're doing refractive corneal surgery and you're going to put a laser, in that office-based center as well. If you're doing, that's where office-based surgery centers really, really do well, is in the in a private pay sector. They can be okay in the third-party pay sector, but there's reimbursement challenges there.
Sure. Well, when you bring up ASC, it reminds me of a saying that you had that was very important to me when I first started to practice, the Lindstrom 5 A's, and one of those A's, of course, being the ASC. Do you want to review those for our younger viewers? If you haven't heard of this, this is fantastic. This changed the way I focused on my career.
Yeah, well, let's see if I can do it and remember them all. You help me off.
I'll help you.
But the number one is availability.
Yeah.
So if you want to be successful and busy, show up, dress up and show up in the office, right? So have office hours, and so that's availability. Number two is affability.
Yep.
Meaning that you treat your patients well,
of
and
course.
They say positive things. And number three actually is ability. So it does matter to be good at. It does matter to be good at what you do. But interestingly enough, if you're available and another doctor's not available, even if that doctor might have greater availability, the patient's going to see you. And again, if you treat the patient well, even though you might not be quite as skilled as the best surgeon in the world, if that the best surgeon in the world has a bad bedside manner, you're going to actually do better as well. So that was the classic three was, availability, affability and ability, and then own an ambulatory surgery center is certainly important as well. And then in the modern world, and this one sometimes make people uncomfortable, I call it advertising, but some form of internal and external
promotion.
Marketing.
Sure.
Yeah, promotion. So to make it an A, I called it advertising, but it's basically you have to.
Get the word out.
Make people aware that you exist. Right?
Yeah, you got to get the word out, for sure.
Today it's social media, but in some cases it can actually be actual external marketing. But people come into your office, see what the images, they look you up on the internet. You may be in a blog or two, et cetera. So those, I think I got it. Those are the five A's.
You got it.
I haven't added another one since, so...
But no, like, those are such important principles for the young doctor starting in the career. It really makes a world of difference. And, like you say, for the promotion within your practice, I always think every cataract patient I do surgery on, he or she has a bunch of grandkids who are prime age, and they probably want LASIK too. If that patient, your cataract patient, doesn't know you even offer it, he or she can't tell their grandkids.
Yeah, number one source of referrals, even though, we're pretty integrated with both MD and optometric referral in our practice, the biggest source of referrals continues to be word of mouth. And what I learned early on, and I had my mentors as well, was to ask every patient to send their friends, basically. So some patient would say to you, "Oh, Dr. Lindstrom, you're great. Thank you. You did such a nice job of my cataract surgery." And I would say, "Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate that. Tell your friends. The biggest compliment you can pay me is to send me your friends." And it's interesting. They just kind of brighten up and they go, "Oh, I mean, you'd like me to do that? You'd like me to recommend you?" And I go, "Yes, I'd like you to recommend me." And I'm sure in a Beverly Hills practice, it's critically important, and in certainly in our practice in Minneapolis, it's certainly very important. But I also satellited out to small communities in rural Minnesota, just because I enjoyed it for decades.
Sure.
It was important even in the smaller community. So,
yeah, I like the idea. I tell patients when they're so thankful and so happy on post-op day one or post-op week one, I usually give them five business cards and say, "Do me a favor, tell five people this week."
Yeah, there you go. That's the tell your friends. That's what. So my mentor on how to talk to patients was a name that many people know, Malcolm McCannell. But, I mean, he just had a style that was very enviable. But, when I was a very young doctor, I'd just watch him interact with patients. And then he'd say, "Well, send me your friends." And I'd over and over and over again. And it was interesting. The patient would just grin from ear to ear and, I can do something in return for what you've done for me, and besides, pay my bill, but it's something that can be very powerful.
Yeah, patients, fellow residents or young residents are sometimes surprised to hear that my number one referral source is, in fact, like you said, just word of mouth. Right. And it's the strongest, right. Means the most. Are we training enough ophthalmologists? We continue to have nationwide still only about 460 ophthalmology residency spots a year. So we're only graduating 460 a year. Not all work full time. Like, look at me, I'm not working full time at the moment. Are we training enough?
No. So when I talk about practice, you know, economics sort of at a helicopter level, the number I have is that we train about 450 residents a year, and so 460, you and I have about the same numbers, and that somewhere around 500 retire every year. So every year there are 50 less ophthalmologists, and you know that's small, but I mean every decade there are 500 less.
Yeah.
And then with the aging population, if you look at the amount of care that's required over the age of 65, and it's just not an immediate turnoff, but I mean, over 65, requires 10x the eye care that under 65 does.
So for sure.
As the population ages, the demand continues to explode. And so one thing that is nice, if you will, or reassuring to the younger ophthalmology doctor is they'll be busy, right? So they're not going to be sitting on their hands. They're going to be extremely busy. They will have to, more even than we have, learn to be efficient. And then probably over time, we will of necessity continue to need to work collegially with care extenders. And I mean, the number one care extender is optometry, but another potential care extender is physician's assistants and nurse practitioners. And a third is certified ophthalmic medical technicians and the like. So I'm a big advocate of what I've called it's OLEID. I call it the ophthalmologist-led integrated eye care delivery model. So I start with ophthalmology-led because it could be, led by any number of people, but ophthalmology-led and then integrated eye care delivery model. And that means working side by side, MDs, ODs, nurse practitioners,
a team approach,
or physicians, assistants, techs, opticians, and the like. But at the top, leading is the ophthalmologist, and that's what our practice is. And we have all of the above, and they all play a meaningful role. And when we're all working side by side, some of these turf battles have a way of going away, but who decides what people do in our practice is the ophthalmologist, right?
Right.
So, every practice may have a slightly different culture, and we certainly have laws and other things that may be different state to state. But I like it when an ophthalmologist is leading a practice and making those decisions, and usually those decisions are then made in the best interest of patients.
Yeah, I do like that team approach. I think it makes it very, very helpful to treat the maximum of patients and that each person can do what they're really ultimately best trained for.
That's right. And every year we have more optometrists, and I think some people will think of that as a bad thing. I think over time we're going to find it's a good thing because it's going to be required to nationwide deliver eye care. And we'll still be at, if you will, the top of that pecking order. But every year there's also more nurse practitioners and physician's assistants. Where we're really challenged is in that whole field of ophthalmic assistant to certified ophthalmic technician to certified ophthalmic, technologist to certified ophthalmic medical technologist. There's sort of, we have ophthalmic assistant A, B, and then COT COMT, and there's nobody training them, unfortunately, in a meaningful number other than our own practices, and we're very short nationwide on that support group. So everyone's trying to figure out a way to solve that problem, but nobody has been able to figure out how to do it yet. So,
and then the
nurses too,
Yeah.
So.
Like in the UK, a lot of the nurse practitioners are doing all the intravitreal injections.
That's right. The only thing we're not short of, and I don't mean this in a negative way because I'm very positive, the only thing we actually are not short of is optometrists. And so the practice that's on their knees and is going to try to, figure out what to do next, you'll just think about how to take advantage of that, of those colleagues. Maybe a quick anecdote. You may or may not leave this in, Uday, but I had a pretty close friend, young ophthalmologist, joined a practice in northern Minnesota. I won't name the city, but a very nice northern Minnesota city, but still northern Minnesota. There were two senior ophthalmologists. They recruited this young ophthalmologist, so three doctor practice. Well, the two senior ophthalmologists retired. So here was this young, basically, I think he was probably about 35-year-old ophthalmologist who had a three ophthalmologist practice all of a sudden. And he did everything he could to try to recruit, another ophthalmologist to join him, and he just couldn't get anyone to come to that that individual town. So he said, well, I'm going to shut down. You know, he called me up, said, I'm going to shut down, and I'm going to move, to the Twin Cities and join a group. Are you looking for anyone? And I said, well, you're a great doctor. We might think about it, but, here's an alternative. Why don't you hire four optometrists?
Yeah.
And basically they can do, because they were, a comprehensive ophthalmology practice. They had an optical shop. They sold glasses, did contact lenses. They did a lot of primary care. And then you just do those things that you don't feel comfortable, or the state laws don't allow an optometrist to do. And to be honest, 10 years later, he's one of the happiest ophthalmologists I know. He stayed alone. He's got a very busy surgical and complex medical practice. And then he has four employee optometrists who... And in a smaller town, the local hospital allows them to take call, and he backs them up, but he really has to go in, if you will. And so rather than that community having no eye care, they now have an extremely high quality eye care with a superb ophthalmologist and his four optometrists. Employees. So, it was a win for the local community, a win for him.
Sure.
And a win. The optometrists are ecstatic. They love it, as they get a very interesting practice as well. And so it's kind of like you can create a win-win-win. It doesn't work everywhere, but I think it's a model that is sustainable and that might work other places as well.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, surgically, we're going to get busier and busier and busier. With that aging population, the amount of retina disease, glaucoma disease, cataract, it's just going to keep increasing. And so surgically, with every year we're creating a deficit number of ophthalmologists, we're going to work harder and harder, or as you would say, be more efficient even.
Yeah. Well, when I started, again, another anecdote, but when I started in practice, the classical private practitioner would see two patients an hour, right?
Yeah.
And no longer the case. And do about 200 surgical cases a year, right? Now the ophthalmologist has to see at least four, and in our practice, our ophthalmologist sees six.
Yeah.
And as we look ahead, I think they need to see 8 to 10 patients an hour, and they'll be doing 1,000 to 1,500 cases a year, and you have to be much more efficient to do that. Probably, I'll just pass this on as well. I mean, most ophthalmologists are going to be 4 days, if they work 5 days a week, not everybody does, but if you work 5 days a week, you'll be 4 days in the office and 1 day in the OR. And so one thing that some ophthalmologists neglect a little bit is paying adequate attention to their office-based practice. And there's a lot of revenue, and efficiencies available in the office-based practice with a little focus as well. And then one needs to go somewhere where they can do all the cases that are generated in 4 days in the clinic, and that's going to be 1,000 to 1,500. You need to be able to do those in 1 day in the OR.
Yeah.
So you need a pretty efficient OR.
You got to do 25 cases, right? You
got to do 20, 30 cases a day on your surgery day, and which is very doable, as we know. And then see 40 to 50 patients a day in the office, and that's the future. And it's just more people are going to get quality care, and then I think have 1 to 2 optometrists working by your side. So
that's awesome. So let's start to wrap this up. I want to finish on a simple topic, which is, so you're on your 10th five-year plan, which is amazing. Of those 10...
I'm on my 11th.
Oh, 11th. Of the 10 previous five-year plans, what have been some of the big wins or biggest challenges or best ups, toughest downs?
Well, the biggest challenges... has been, creating balance. And amazingly enough, even in my 11th five-year plan, it's still, if I wanted to, I could get in an airplane even today and fly somewhere in the world, for a meeting or a medical advisory board. So even today, with, I retired from clinical practice December 31, just this last year, 2022, after 50 years. Even today, without seeing patients, I could be, you know, too committed, you know, to my profession. So I think number one is to do those five-year plans and make sure they include your family. And I definitely went through periods in my life where I was out of balance. And, you know, fortunately, I got reeled in, you know, along the way a little bit before it was too late. But, I mean, I'm very happily married, but my wife is my second wife. And, you know, I think my first wife might have paid a little bit of a penalty for some of that imbalance. You know, just try not to get out of balance, and make sure you have some time for yourself as well, so that whatever it is you like to do, yourself and for friends are critically important, I think, as well. So those are sort of the key lessons, and then to realize that your desires are going to continue to change, and that just goes back to the 5-year plan again. So keep upgrading your plan and actually write it down. And then review it every 3 months and make sure you didn't make a mistake as to what you really wanted to do. And you'll find that things change. When I was younger, I said, when my second home, I wanted to be in the mountains. I loved to ski. I had all these places picked out in Vail and whatnot. And then when I finally was in a position to have a second home, I didn't want to go to the mountains anymore. I went to Newport Beach and bought a place in the sunny Newport Beach and played tennis and golf. And while I still ski a little, I don't ski very much. So, I spent 30 years planning to buy a second home in the mountains. I had them picked out, I had them priced out, and then when I was finally ready to do it, I bought a
place on the beach,
in Newport Beach.
So. Yeah, so different years.
You will find that what you want to do changes, and it will depend on if you have children, what they decide to do. In my case, they both moved back to Minnesota, got good jobs, started having children, and then that changes what you want to do as well. So I would say you have to have some flexibility, and I think medicine and ophthalmology in our case is in what I call a very demanding mistress. It does take a lot of time. It can totally consume you, and just be careful, not to let it totally consume you.
I think that's fantastic advice. I think we all struggle with that balance. And slowly but surely over time, we figure out what works best for us and our families.
That's right. And as long as you keep honestly looking at it and analyzing it, and then asking those people that matter to you how what you're doing is impacting them. So you might be very happy and then find out that your wife or husband and your children are not so happy. Or your friends haven't heard from you in a long time, or how come we haven't seen you at men's tennis on Monday night in 6 weeks, or you're a four-person golf group and you haven't played the whole summer. Every now and then you need to see how is this impacting others as well. So,
fantastic advice. Well, I continue to admire you, and I'm going to take away from this that I need to get a 5-year plan mentality, and we'll go from there. But I want to thank you again for participating in this podcast. And for all our Cataract Coach viewers, we're going to have a podcast like this once or twice a month for the foreseeable future, where we'll do a deep dive into some of the more hidden aspects of ophthalmology and how you can achieve your own potential and balance in your career and personal life.
Well, thanks, Uday. So really appreciate the time, and you're special to me. So thanks for having me on your show. Yep.
Thanks for enjoying that podcast with me. I trust that you learned some very valuable information that'll help you throughout the course of your career and your personal journey in ophthalmology and ocular surgery. Be sure to check out the podcast version as well. If you want to listen to this podcast while you're driving to work or working out at the gym, it's available on iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you find your favorite podcasts. And I'll see you back in just a couple of weeks for the next edition of the Cataract Coach podcast series. Thank you.